This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballo, 20th Century History Guy.
A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. Those were the words of Alexander Hamilton, the nation's first Treasury Secretary, in the years following the Revolutionary War. Turn on the TV these days, of course, and you'll hear a very different tune.
The next great political battle over how to deal with America's debt is being described as Armageddon.
The U.S. government reached its $14.3 trillion debt ceiling this morning.
That's add another $3 trillion to our national debt. This would be a disaster.
Debt is going to catastrophic levels. We will have a debt crisis.
What we are possibly looking at is something far worse than the Depression.
We will not be able to grow our way out of this problem.
On each episode of our show, we take a topic from the world around us and explore its historical context. Today, with the national debt at more than $14 trillion, almost as much as the entire GDP of the nation, we're asking when the national debt became such a problem for us. Have there been times in American history when debt wasn't seen as such a dangerous thing? And if so, what changed?
We're going to start by handing things over to the man who can shed a little light on that Hamilton quote about national debt being a national blessing. And that's none other than our 18th century guy, Peter Onuf. Now, some of you might know him as a Thomas Jefferson expert, so you have to take his words about Hamilton with a grain of salt. You see, this debt issue was one of the biggest points of disagreement between Hamilton and Jefferson. And so with that caveat to our listeners, why don't you tell us, Peter, how in the world Hamilton could possibly have thought that the national debt might be a good thing?
Yeah. Well, listen, you know, the one thing we all have in common now is that debt, and that is a sort of an echo of what Hamilton was saying. In Hamilton's day, to have a debt was to create a common interest, and that is creditors would have a stake in America Incorporated. They would feel bound and obligated to support the enterprise. And remember this, we're talking about the collapse of the American system now. Well, that's probably not going to happen right away, but it could have happened in 1787.
A lot more imminent in the 18th century than it
absolutely
is in the 21st.
Right. And you needed debt to create a kind of cement to hold things together.
Because what else was there?
Nothing. Because we have a group of states that had no common history until the Revolution.
Right.
Who don't trust each other.
And Peter, is it true that all those states had individual debts?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that to bring that together forge a nation as much as writing that Constitution.
You're so right, Brian. And that's the genius of Hamilton's financial plan, was to assume those individual state debts for the cost of the Revolution.
He's not creating the debt.
No, he's transforming what is everybody says is a burden. And he's making it the foundation of a financial system that's going to give the United States the capacity to borrow in the future. Nobody's going to lend to you in the next war if you defaulted on the last war. That's the end of you as an effective government.
So he's not just saying it's great to borrow as much money as we can.
No.
What he's saying is, folks, we owe this money.
Right.
What we can do is we can make it a national debt rather than this fragmented kind of specious local debt.
Right. And he's making a political argument for it, that it can be used as a fundamental instrument of nation making. And that's precisely what Jefferson disagreed with, because Jefferson was concerned that this was the equivalent of bombing the village to save it. That is, if we created a strong central government in the United States, what was the point of the Revolution in the first place? Because that was a revolution against centralized authority.
But what would Jefferson do about the money that was owed?
Well, he and other optimistic Americans believe that there are resources that the country has, both in import duties and land sales, that can quickly service that debt so that it will not be an encumbrance on future generations.
So what's really at stake is how quickly the debt is paid off.
Right.
And Hamilton said, well, there's no rush, folks, because the longer we have it, we're kind of indebted to each other. It's a glue
that will hold
the country together.
Nice way
and
to
Jefferson
put it.
Says, look, folks, we've got these resources. Why do we want debt? We'll find other things to hold us together.
Yes. And after all, the purpose of the Revolution was not to create a business enterprise, not to institutionalize the position of creditors.
And Peter, let me ask you about those creditors, because he didn't imagine everybody owning a piece of this debt, right?
No. Or the Chinese.
That really is a 20th century invention, right. Maybe a 19th with the Civil War.
So who did he imagine and who did he want to own this debt?
In the 18th century, you would be focused on political and economic elites, what you might call a moneyed aristocracy. And that term is crucial because that's what Jefferson and his colleagues called the creditors of the U.S.
Yeah, why do you rob banks? Well, that's where the money is. Well, are you going to go to borrow money?
Right, here's the problem. Aristocracy suggests a particular privileged class that has an advantage over and dominates the rest of society. That's, according to Jefferson, what we fought the revolution to get away from.
Right. And what's worse, to pay off that debt, we're going to have to raise our taxes.
That's right.
That's also what we fought the revolution
Every
against.
Every man is going to pay taxes so that a few privileged people can live high on the hog.
Well, there's no doubt that Peter does a very compelling job of channeling his man, Jefferson. And Peter, I want you to know, this might come in handy for you if you ever give up this radio gig. Demand for Jefferson impersonators, we're told, is strong as it's ever been. Hamilton impersonators, on the other hand, have been having a little harder time finding work. But there is at least one guy who still makes it his mission to keep Hamilton's flame alive. We found him at home on his farm in, of all places, Southern Virginia.
Hello?
Hello, is this Alexander Hamilton?
Yes, sir, this is.
Yeah, right.
All right, I got to ask you, Al, with the huge run-up of debt and the crisis over the debt ceiling, are you taking a lot of heat these days? Do you have to wear a paper bag over your head when you perform?
Absolutely not, sir. To hold me responsible for what's going on in your economy today is like holding Augustus responsible for the burning of Rome.
Whoa.
We only do American history, Al. Let's stick to this country.
A very telling analogy.
Let's change the topic here.
Let me just say that there are a great many things that were done to derail elements of the Hamiltonian system that might have been useful. Mm-hmm. And I think a lesson that may have gotten lost somewhere is that many of your agents of government are also, they're speculators. They're involved in your markets. And I think those two functions may be mutually exclusive.
Well, now, Jefferson always thought you had, in your personal and private life, that is with respect to finances and so forth, that you were on the up and up, absolutely an honorable man. It was just your ridiculous preference for monarchy and aristocracy that
got in the way.
So,
I've always found it ironic that a man who was carried about on a pillow, that's one of his earliest memories, should call me an aristocrat when I, on the other hand, was an orphan living on the island of St. Croix, making my own way at the age of 11.
Yeah, maybe illegitimate, too. So,
only because women were disenfranchised, sir.
Now, that is a very progressive way to respond to that. Terrific.
That's actual news. Hamilton advocates women's suffrage.
We are going to unmask Alexander Hamilton now and reveal the crystal within. This is Bill Crystal. Bill is the Alexander Hamilton impersonator. If you just tuned in, you might have thought we really had Alexander Hamilton on the line. So Jefferson is seen as a visionary and I think I hear you saying that Hamilton was a visionary too, but we just don't see his vision. I mean, Hamilton, you got shot, you died, and you didn't get a chance to consolidate your reputation for posterity. So what is the vision, the Hamiltonian vision that we just don't see?
You isolate something key. For 24 years, Adams and Jefferson were free to say anything they wanted about Hamilton, and he couldn't respond.
Right.
And he has been saddled with this legacy. What was his vision? I think his vision was one of an America that was truly possessed of a mixed economy, where wealth was not perceived to come only from the land, but wealth could be created through trade, mm-hmm. and especially through manufacturing,
right.
and that this could become a country where not only a small percentage of people would create wealth and therefore work for everyone else, but that everyone could have a decent standard of living. Mm-hmm. I think that's the Hamiltonian dream, and I think it has worked well for us up to a point.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that the a real aristocrat is Thomas Jefferson and other people who fetishized the land, the agrarians, that the real Democrat is Alexander Hamilton.
That would be my take on it, and I know that's a complete reversal of what most people have been taught to believe. But we need to remember, Jefferson was a physiocrat.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth comes from the land,
right.
And that means wealth goes to the landowners, and they parcel it out by buying luxuries that are produced by other people. But mm-hmm. There's certainly not going to be a lot of wealth in a system like that.
Bill, Hamilton was also a problem solver. So I want to ask you what Hamilton would have to say to Boehner or Obama about the current situation we face with a colossal debt that, you know, threatens to become as large as the GDP of the nation.
It's not a national blessing.
Well, as Hamilton said, it's a national blessing if the means to extinguish that debt are also present.
Right.
That's the second part of the sentence that he's not usually credited with.
Mm-hmm.
I think what he would say is don't lose heart, that most of what an economy is about, most of what a government is about, is confidence. And as long as the people are confident and are willing to invest in the government and in its debt, then you don't have a problem.
It seems to me the key thing, though, Bill, is in order to service the debt, in order to create the confidence in the nation's creditors, you have to show the capacity to raise revenue, and it comes right down to this. You have to impose taxes, and that's what certainly Hamilton was prepared to do. So you're suggesting that Jefferson is a kind of pushes the libertarian button, makes us feel good about our liberties. Hamilton is a realist, and he pushes the taxation button. That is, if there's going to be real confidence in the government, it's because it has the capacity to raise revenue. And that's, of course, the third rail these days. You can't talk about taxation. That may be one of the problems with Hamilton now.
Have you thought about going on the road as Hamilton? I think you've got it.
Hey, Bill, thanks so much for talking with
us. It's been terrific. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Right. Bye-bye.
That's Bill Kristol, an Alexander Hamilton impersonator in Southern Virginia. Today, we're taking on one of the big issues fueling conflict on Capitol Hill these last few months, and that's the national debt. How much is too much, and how has the answer to that question changed over the past two centuries? As we do with each of our shows, we've been inviting your questions and comments about today's topic on our website and Facebook. Our producers have invited a few of the people who weighed in there to join us on the phone.
Our first call today is coming from all the way across the Pacific. It's Andy in Tokyo, Japan. Andy, welcome to Backstory.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Hey. So we're talking about debt today, and you've got a question for us.
I do. I am an American living abroad, so
mm-hmm.
I have maybe a little different perspective
right.
than some other people. And I'm seeing a lot of people who are fighting right now about one side or the other on what we should do about the debt. And I'm curious if maybe people are kind of missing something that history would tell us about
mm-hmm.
what other kinds of factors pop up
right.
when there's a crisis in the national debt.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, guys, what do you see in your centuries? What else is going on when there's an explosion in the national debt? Is it
wow.
is it war? Is it trade? Is it
this is the
energy?
This is the big question. We're going to set up the entire program and maybe the next two with this question. What else is happening during periodic debt crises? And I'll kick that one off, guys, if you don't mind, and get it to you as fast as possible. No debt, no country. The Americans go into debt, the Patriots, in order to win independence because, of course, they couldn't pay as they went because they had nothing to pay with. Scarcity of currency and capital and credit. They had to turn to Europe and they had to turn to Dutch bankers. And the whole history of the U.S. is predicated on creditability, that is, creating a government that was capable of borrowing. So in a way, if you want a short version of the Constitution is a device that enables Americans to service long-term debts. And that's another name for the country. The country is a long-term debt.
That's amazing. So the United States is basically a debtor.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what we are.
Well, let's, you know, think about this, Ed, for just a minute. It's the fantasy that the nation is immortal.
Yeah.
What does that mean, really? I mean, we think of it romantically in mystical terms across the generations, but what we're really talking about is that obligations made now are good in the future. That is, we commit ourselves and we commit our children to meet these obligations. That's what a country is.
So it's almost as if our motto could be too big to fail.
You got it,
right?
So although, Ed, I would just add, in Peter's period, it's more like we hope to become too big to fail.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You know, we were on the brink of failure. That's why it was so important to get this financial situation straightened out.
So you came out with this big statement in response to Andy's big question.
It was a very big question.
Yeah. And my big answer is the key variable in the history of American debt is war.
Yep.
From 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, 21st century, the driver is war, even though we often think of it as governmental policy.
No argument for
action.
Me.
Ed. Well, that's not any interesting. What could I say that would make you argue with me, Brian?
No. I want you to elaborate in your century what did it.
Well, you know, I think in many ways the United States would not have had the confidence to go to war against half of itself in the Civil
That's
War.
That's a great point.
You know, without the capacity to secure debt. And the Confederacy would not have had the confidence to go to war against the United States had it not believed, somewhat correctly it proved, that it could secure the wherewithal to fight by borrowing the money and material from England and France, right? So without the success, Peter, of your founding fathers, we never would have had the Civil War because the two...
Well, every war is a bet on the future, and we take out loans with the idea that the future will turn out in a certain way and we can service those things.
Well, so, Andy, I don't want to deflect attention away from the United States, but I just want to ask, isn't there quite a bit of debt over there in your adopted country?
I understand that the Japanese national debt is twice the Japanese GDP.
Not only is there a ton of debt here, but there is a ton of buying of the U.S. debt.
They don't get enough. They need ours, too.
And we're in a very strange position right now because of the recent disasters here, where everyone knows that the debt is going to have to explode. So the one thing you see here everywhere on signs on the train, on advertisements on television, it's from the government, but it's also from companies and schools and organizations of all sorts. Everywhere you see this little message that says "Ganbare Japan," which means everybody keep working, keep trying, don't give up. And there's a sense that, well, we've been here before. You know, the Japanese completely lost in World War II.
Right.
And not only did they succeed, but they thrived by saying, all right, well, let's give up on what we thought was going to be the future and see what we can build next.
Right.
And there's a real sense of that even now.
And Andy, what you're saying is that there isn't a lot of finger pointing. It hasn't become a cleavage in the body politic the way it has in the U.S.
No. Maybe more importantly, there's a sense that maybe the national government is not doing the best job, but regionally, people are really doing what needs to be done.
Yeah.
So, Andy, you're telling us that if we increase the debt, maybe finally we'll get rid of all these partisan divisions. We'll all be in the same debt boat together.
Is that what he was telling us? Yeah, we need a Japanese level debt. Right. Well, that's an inspirational message. Thanks a lot, Andy.
You bet. Thanks, gentlemen.
Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye.
Ed, I get the feeling, in Peter's period, I think it's, you know, if we're doing a scorecard, debt Well, you got its supporters and its detractors. Yeah, yeah. It's good. It's bad. It's complicated. In the 19th century,
it's a simpler time.
It's a simpler time. Debt is a bad thing, right? National debt.
And here's a case where America really is exceptional, because you could go into debt if you were going to build one of the largest nation states in the world, or you could just sell immense amounts of land that you happen to own and you happen to take away from the indigenous people in order to fund the growth of this state.
Right. Yeah.
So the United States is actually able to dodge this crucial question for generations, except for wartime.
And because we have this surplus, so to speak. You know, wouldn't you say it's in the shape of land?
Well, yeah, we're selling off the family silver.
Exactly. You know?
Well, but there's also internal improvements. It's important to keep in mind how much British capital flows into the early republic and to your period in forms of railroad financing,
which makes
and so
that
forth.
Land more valuable and more
Absolutely.
Accessible.
And so states like Indiana are going to borrow in order to finance an elaborate internal improvements program, and then they go belly up. And so,
because every other state financed
right.
one too.
And that is the big fact of mid-19th century public finance before the Civil War, is that the credit ratings of American states go into the toilet.
Yeah.
And it took until well into the 20th century for states to get the highest credit ratings again.
So, Peter, what you're saying is that in some ways we shifted the burden of debt from the federal government to the states, and the states didn't really handle it all that well.
No, they sure didn't.
And there's another irony in what you described, that the people that the United States were in debt to were the English.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
So we fought a war. So let me see if I understand the story you've told. Yeah. Basically, the founding of America is created by a crisis of imperial debt by the English, right?
That's
so,
right.
Because they go into debt to protect the American colonies.
Yep.
They come and say, hey, guys, how about helping us pay off that debt that we incurred to save you from the French and the Indians?
Seems
right?
reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, oh, wait, no, don't rebel. Oh, my God, we lost America. But, hey, how about this? We will loan you money on the private side.
And I know we ran up some debt during the Civil War, but I don't see it showing up in, 20 years later, 30 years later, is a big percentage of GDP. How did that debt get paid out?
I thought you were going to say you don't see it turning up 20 years later as the defining issue in Gilded Age politics, which, my friend, I know you know, in fact, it was the defining issue.
So in what form did it take?
Well, it never really dies down. From the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s, the debt from the Civil War is the defining issue of American politics. That's really what people are fighting about, is how that debt's going to be repaid. On the cheap, with greenbacks,
or
in a moderate way with silver, or in the soundest way with gold, right? Now, at the same time, massive investment in the United States, especially on these transcontinental railroads, and massive investment in steel and coal mines and all this sort of stuff. And a lot of the times back in the shadows, that's actually foreigners who were doing this. Mm-hmm. And so some people look at all of this, and this becomes a popular and a scary vein in American history. What's the connection between all this kind of shady private investment of foreigners and somebody manipulating this public debate over how this big debt's going to be repaid? Some people look and say, you know what I think it is? I think it's a global banking conspiracy.
Yep.
I think the Jews are behind this. And it becomes, ironically, the sort of the one virulent strain ever since.
Yeah.
When the Federal Reserve System's created and all this, this sense that somebody who's not America is controlling our financial future.
Hey, guys, we have a call from Delray, Florida. It's Kate. Kate, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Debt is on the table today. We got to deal with it. What's your question?
If you look at where our national debt was in 1860, we had about $65 million as a national debt. And then by 1863, it had spiked up to $1 billion. And this was the first major spike in our national debt.
That's
so
right.
I think, you've got to draw the line from somewhere. And my question is, in what ways does the reentry of an economically devastated South contribute to the national debt after the Civil War?
Good question, Kate. And
I'm all over it, Ed.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you notice who's stepping up, the guy with the Southern accent here on all this. You know, it's upside down. You might think that the devastation of the South contributed to the national debt. But in all honesty, the North actually took advantage of the South.
Get over it.
No, I know. I'm just telling the truth. And I'm not saying this was even wrong. But the banking system was recast during the Civil War itself while the Republicans were in power. The currency system based on greenbacks was actually preferential to the North. The tariff structure benefited the North. And the pension system benefited Northern veterans. And the South was actually a net payer of the debt.
A kind of reparations, you might say.
Yeah. It's really, that's a really good point, Peter. I've never thought of it that way, but it was a kind of direct reparation. So it devastated Southern state debt, but as far as the nation, it barely looked back and, in fact, just continued taking advantage of the advantage of the North that came out of the war.
So the Confederate debt was wiped out, right, Ed? I mean, it was...
all the individual bondholders, one way to think about this... They just
lost it.
Yeah. So all of
it's one way to wipe out debt.
So you have the sources of resources that might have helped the South deal with the debt that it incurred. Mm-hmm. Land prices plummet.
Right.
The abolition of slavery in economic terms for white people was a loss of $3 billion. Mm-hmm. And the state governments had to pay for things like artificial limbs, you know, things like that, which were an enormous part of the economy of the post-war Southern government. So,
and ironically, Ed, I think some of those state governments, in fact, you may have taught me this, I think some of those state governments started going into debt to do things like build railroads that northern states gave up on in the 1840s and 1850s.
Pretty much privatized by the
The Southern states say, hey, you know, these are going to be engines of economic development.
And so they went into debt to England to help fund a lot of this.
So, Kate, the first point I think we're making here is that you have to distinguish the federal from state debts. And what Ed's talking about is a financial crisis for state governments in the South after the Civil War. Actually, because the federal government had developed such a financial apparatus, so effective and such capacity to raise revenue, that, as he suggests, the South was actually a net loser paying for servicing the debt.
Yeah. And there's another way of thinking about this. You know, you remember FDR refers to the South in the Great Depression as the nation's number one economic problem. And that's partly because the South had not really been invested in by the nation in all the generations after the Civil War. Now, frankly, white Southerners did okay, that they kind of regained their balance. They were poorer than white Northerners, but the black Southerners were never given a chance.
That's right.
You know, the 40 acres of mule did not come to pass. Any kind of real investment in the future of African Americans in the South was not made. And you could argue that the South began to drive up the national debt really after the reintegration of the South into the nation after World War II, and that it's only with the Civil Rights Movement and the use of the federal government, sometimes through defense spending, frankly, and through other kinds of investment in the South. So I think we might think about this regionalization of the debt also by thinking of it in terms of who the real victims of all of this were.
That's a great point.
And how long it
took
for the debts to begin to be repaid.
And what you're saying is that, in fact, if you're looking at federal transfer payments, the federal investment in different parts of the country, the South is doing very, very well in the modern post-World War II period.
Even though they're the biggest critics of federal spending.
It's true, but
you know, that goes back to
the West does pretty well, too.
So it's interesting that those who are receiving the transfer payments from the federal government somehow resent it.
Yeah, ingrates.
Yeah, well, I think it's partly because of this memory of, for so long, the South felt as if it was paying in but not getting anything back.
That's right.
Even though, really, for two or three generations now, the South has been the net recipient of tax dollars. But it's come in the form often of defense spending and of welfare payments.
And that's why we're going to secede. We've had enough of this, Kate.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so I think, you know, your question is so good. I think we pull the camera back a little bit. We can see that the regional stage of this also needs to be reconsidered as a sort of a racial stage.
Yeah.
And when we do that, we see that in many ways we're still paying the debts of the Civil War and of the slavery that preceded it.
Hey, Kate, why would someone in Delray Beach be interested in the debt?
Yeah, it's not really part of the South, is it?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. I'm originally from Knoxville, Tennessee.
All right, so. Where I received my education. Good talking to you.
And when I moved down here, you know, I just started reading about the Civil War, and it's just become a part of my everyday activities now.
That's sick.
Hey, Kate, don't you think you should be out there earning a living and paying down the debt instead of reading about the Civil War?
You know, it's just, no, I'm not so.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Kate.
Absolutely. So like two desperados, we'll ride off in the sun. But just remember,
you owe me one. That's one you owe me. It's time for another short break. But don't go away. When we get back, we'll push the story of the national debt forward into my century, the 20th century.
You're listening to Backstory with the American History Guys. We'll be back in a minute. But just remember, you owe me one.